Republicans on Capitol Hill are racing to find support for their tax bill just hours ahead of a critical vote that was pushed to today or perhaps sometime this weekend. Republican tax writers are reworking the tax bill, trying to find a way to satisfy competing interests and shore up the necessary votes. That's where we'll begin this week in review with Christine Bremer Moogly. She is an attorney with Bremer and Trollope law offices in Wausau. She was a member of the Electoral College in 2008 and 2012. Christine, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
And Owen Robinson is with us on this Friday. He's a columnist with the West Bend Daily News and a blogger at bootsandsabers.com. Owen, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning, and good morning, Christine.
Good morning.
Well, tensions were running high in the Senate last night when Senator Bob Corker, a Republican from Tennessee, was demanding last-minute offsets for the tax bill out of fear that it would raise the deficit. Meanwhile, Republican Senators John McCain of Arizona and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska are saying they support the Senate tax bill. McCain was on the fence over concerns about the federal deficits, but said yesterday it would spur the economy and ease the tax burden for middle-class families. Murkowski came around to the bill after a provision was added this week to allow oil drilling in her parts of in Alaska. And President Trump tweeted this morning that the bill is getting better and better and called out obstructionist Dems for trying to block it because they think it's too good and won't be given any credit. So the Senate is expected to vote sometime here. Owen, what do you make of the bill and the Joint Committee on Taxation saying yesterday afternoon that it will add $1 trillion to the deficit over 10 years?
Well, I think it does appear that the Senate's getting much, much closer to having the votes, or that they have the votes. I'm hearing from various sources this morning on various media outlets that it looks like they have the 50 votes. They can afford to lose two and still pass this. Senator Johnson, our senator, was out this morning saying that he was able to wrangle some concessions regarding pass-through taxes and all sorts of things last night that they're getting into the bill and they'll probably vote on. Of course, as we've seen with the Senate, you never know if someone's going to balk at the end or try to hold them hostage for some other pet project like drilling in Alaska or whatever that's out there. But I think it's important to remember a couple things as we back up. And there's all the machinations that are happening in this Senate bill and certainly a lot of concerns then. Much of it, we must remember, doesn't matter that much because this bill still has to go to reconciliation with the House bill, which is entirely different. There's a lot of differences between what the House passed and what the Senate is looking likely to pass. And a lot of that's going to have to be resolved in reconciliation, then go back to the houses for votes. So it doesn't do us a lot of good to get bogged down in the details of what's passed until we have the actual bill that they're going to vote on. But I think as long as we have a tax bill, from a political angle, it's critical that the Republicans pass this. I think they have rightfully gained a reputation in the United States that they are unable to govern right now. They're unable to do big things and pass big legislation, even though they do control the majorities of both houses of Congress. And I think that if they don't get this done, it's going to be a signal to the American people that we need somebody else in there. But I think from an economic standpoint, if this bill goes through the overall goal of decreasing taxes, particularly on businesses, on our economic engines, on the businesses that drive our economy, to spur growth within our economy, and I think that's what you see a lot of the run-up in the stock market is anticipation of that growth. Stock market is a leading indicator, but I think if as long as we hit those goals of decreasing overall taxes and spurring economic growth, I think that it's all a good thing.
Christine, is this bill getting better and better, as the president says?
Well, no, like most things he says, I think he's wrong about that as well. And I think that I think your comments are really interesting, Owen. You know, if we go back to the big criticism, and you and I have debated this over the Obamacare ACA, one of the big criticisms was that the Republicans didn't have a chance to be involved in it. And if we look back at that debate, and we remember that it was a long debate, it was 25 days of debate versus what they're giving us now, 20 hours of debate. There were months of public hearings. We haven't had one hearing. Not one expert has come forward. So it's a very difficult to say that this is a reflection of democracy when there really hasn't been anything that has been come forward for the public, and the public does not support this bill. when John McCain came forward yesterday and said he would support it, even before the Joint Commission on Taxation report was released, it led you to believe that this was not about really doing the right thing for the people, but it was, as you said, a very important political act for the Republicans. They cannot do good things this season, and we've seen that in this Congress. And so now they're putting forward this bill that is really a sham on the American people. I believe that, you know, I was hoping that Corker yesterday, when Senator Corker from Tennessee said he wasn't going to support it when they found out how poorly the growth was projected, even under the Joint Commission report, which is 0.8% growth, that, you know, he said we have to have a trigger then, because if we don't have a trigger that says we're going to increase taxes or have spending cuts, I can't support this bill because it's going to blow up deficits. And so now apparently they had to come up with another $350 billion in revenue to get this bill through. You know, they have this rule that they're passing this on under reconciliation because they don't want the Democrats to be able to have to vote on this. It's just ridiculous. And so the Democrats have no say. They're going to try and do this with not one Democratic vote, no compromise whatsoever. And what they're going to do is blow up the deficit, and then they're going to become deficit hawks and follow Paul Ryan's playbook, which is to cut taxes for the wealthy and then go after entitlements. He said it. Kevin Brady has said it. They've all recognized that really what this is going to do is to take away money from our social programs. So we're going to give more money to the wealthy, and then we're going to cut Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid.
Let us talk a moment here about the position of Senator Ron Johnson, and let's bring in Ned, who would like to talk about Senator Johnson's stance on the tax plan. Ned, go ahead.
Yes, I'm disappointed with Senator Johnson, who has caved in again, just as he did on the repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act. He has caved in again and now supports the tax reform bill. The basics still remain the same. Large corporations get two-thirds of the tax cut. Secondly, the estate tax should not be repealed because only the richest one out of 500 families currently pay anything. And President Trump's family themselves would get approximately $1 billion tax cut from passing on the wealth of his huge estate to his heirs. Now, this just isn't fair, and as Christine said, there are no hearings. That also is a terrible thing about this bill. We need to have hearings and need to slow down this process. There's nothing that's speeding it up other than there have been no major bills passed by the Republican Party in 2017. That's why they're speeding this through so rapidly. And finally, the American people in polls oppose this by a 49% to 29%, and the rest are undecided. Well, it's quite dramatic how American people oppose this bill.
Ned, thanks for calling in. Owen, I want you to get a word in edgewise here. Go ahead.
Well, Ned covered a lot of different points there, so maybe I'll just touch on a couple of them. And one is disappointment with Senator Johnson. I myself was frustrated with Senator Johnson and his opposition to this and his tactics more so than his goals. And I think what he ended up doing is what we call compromise, which is what I think we want from our legislators, where he took a stance where he wanted, a 25% deduction for pass-through entities to make sure they get better treatment than the C-Corps. In the end, he got 23%, so not quite all the way there, but better than the 19.5% that was in the original bill. That is compromise. And so while he didn't get everything he wanted out of it, he got some of it. I think his actions did make this bill better from a conservative's standpoint, and I think that's a good thing. Meanwhile, they still appear to have the votes to get it through the Senate. But I would point out again, though, that a lot of this stuff, not sure how much it matters to get into the details of whether it's 19.5 or 23 or 25 or 90 until we see the actual bill that comes out of reconciliation.
So, Christine, is it right for Senator Johnson to be hyper-focused on how small businesses fare in this tax bill and the whole pass-through business piece of the tax bill?
Well, you know, I think that progressives in the state initially saw Ron Johnson was coming against the bill, and we're thinking, wow, he's waking up, he's doing something right that's for the people of Wisconsin. And then you find out that really all he's doing is trying to protect people with large amounts of money and pass-throughs. There are some small corporations, mom-and-pop operations that have, you know, pass-through money, but for the most part, there's very large corporations. 70% of total income from pass-throughs goes to 1% of the people, the wealthy. So it's really a bill for the wealthy. But, you know, I think that if he wanted to hold it up for this, that's okay, but he should have done more for the people of Wisconsin. Why not work to take, why do we have a deduction taken away from our students on their student loan debt? Why isn't he fighting for this, to save that for our students? You know, there's so many things in this bill that people don't even know about because they're pushing it through so quickly that it's just outrageous. Ron Johnson should have been fighting for the provisions for the middle class in this bill and not for the wealthy. And really, if you read anything about this pass-through situation, economists say this is really a ridiculous argument because pass-throughs are taxed only once at the individual tax rate when corporations are taxed twice, first at the 20% level, and then when the profits are distributed to the shareholders have to pay tax on it. So effectively, corporations pay more than pass-throughs, and so this was sort of a fight that really didn't mean much. And so I think that Ron Johnson could have done so much more for us, and it's such a disappointment that he did so little, as us having only two senators in the Senate, and Tammy Baldwin not being allowed to have any effective arguments because the Democrats have been silenced.
Let's bring in one more viewpoint here. Matt in Wausau emailed, and Matt says, cite a single place that shows that trickle-down economics actually lead to verifiable improvements for working-class Americans. The current Republican plan is a mirror image of those put forward by George W. Bush, and I think we all remember how that turned out, Matt says. Or do we? Owen, go ahead.
Well, first off, I would remind him that the economic boom in the 60s when the Kennedy tax cuts and in the 80s with the Reagan tax cuts, we saw decades of economic boom after the Reagan tax cuts. So I think that argument's out there, and that's a bit of an esoteric argument at this point. But I would like to go back to what Christine and what Ned kind of mentioned a little bit regarding Senator Johnson in this thing. And I think from a political angle, this is interesting in that you have Democrats criticizing Senator Johnson, who is a conservative Republican, for not advocating for essentially liberal ideas. So they're mad that he's not pulling the Democratic agenda. So it's a bit of a false argument. But for Senator Baldwin, I think that's the more interesting argument. The Democrats politically have rendered themselves utterly meaningless in the Congress because they march in lockstep and they refuse to compromise on anything. This was an opportunity where I think if Senator Baldwin had gone to the Republican leadership in the Senate and said, look, I need, you know, whatever, the tax cut for students, for grad students, or whatever pet issue she wanted to do, those are relatively minor things in this bill that she could have gone and negotiated and tried to get that into the bill with the promise of perhaps supporting it at some point. But not even the fact that the Democrats have said, no, we're not voting this. It doesn't matter what the bill looks like. They could pass something identical to what the Democrats want, and the Democrats would not vote for it at this point because they do not want to give the Republicans and Trump a win before the midterm elections next year. So really, it's the Democrats' fault that they don't have a say in any of this right now.
Christina,
go ahead. First of all, and that's absolutely wrong. Senator Baldwin did attempt to put in amendments here to this, and they were absolutely ignored. She puts in, Senator Baldwin is one of the senators that works harder across party lines than anyone else, and she did put in amendments to this to protect our students, but they were ignored. And, you know, if we look back at we want to talk about the Reagan tax cuts in 1986. That took years to draft that tax reform bill. They worked across party lines. They had drafts. They had hearings. They had compromises. Nothing like that has happened in this bill. And if we go back and look at what President Bush did when he gave a 5% amnesty tax to the large corporations so they would bring their profits back overseas, if you remember, what happened with that money was 90% of it went to the shareholders, to giving dividends to shareholders, or to buying back the stock of their own corporations. The corporations did not use that tax to trickle down. Instead, that tax amnesty to trickle down. Instead, they kept it. In the case right now, yes, the stock market is going fantastically, and I love that because, you know, we all love to see our 401k do a little bit better. But on the other hand, you have to realize that the corporations are not asking for this tax break. And it is very, very likely that when they get it, none of these profits that they get or none of the money that they're able to utilize will go to workers. It never has in the past. There is no evidence, as Matt said in his email. There is no evidence that trickle-down works.
It
will not go to the workers.
It is the Week in Review on this first Friday of December, first day of December as well, for that matter. Christine Bremer-Mugley stays with us. She's an attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau. She was a member of the Electoral College in 2008 and 2012. And Owen Robinson is a columnist with the West Bend Daily News and a blogger at bootsandsabers.com. He stays with us as well. Your insights welcome, 800-642-1234. What do you make of the recent string of sexual misconduct allegations? Should John Conyers and Elle Franken resign? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back in just a moment. House Speaker Paul Ryan says the rash of sexual harassment and sexual assault allegations coming to light could end up being a watershed moment in changing the culture, including on Capitol Hill, that has covered them up far too long. He spoke with NPR's Morning Edition yesterday. We're discussing this moment on Week in Review with Owen Robinson. He's a columnist with the West Bend Daily News and a blogger at bootsandsabers.com. And Christine Bremer-Mugley, an attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau. Your thoughts as well on the week's developments, 800-642-1234. Should Representative John Conyers resign? What about Senator Elle Franken? Was President Trump out of line in calling Senator Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The news media was rocked this week when it was announced that NBC fired Today Show host Matt Lauer after a female colleague accused him of sexual misconduct during the network's coverage of the 2014 Olympics in Sochi. Here's Savannah Guthrie reacting to Lauer's firing Wednesday morning.
I'm heartbroken for Matt. He is my dear, dear friend and my partner, and he is beloved by many, many people here. And I'm heartbroken for the brave colleague who came forward to tell her story and any other women who have their own stories to tell. Mm-hmm. And we are grappling with a dilemma that so many people have faced these past few weeks. How do you reconcile your love for someone with the revelation that they have behaved badly? Mm-hmm. And I don't know the answer to that.
And in addition to that, Minnesota Public Radio announced it was cutting ties with former Prairie Home Companion host Garrison Keillor over allegations of sexual misconduct. He reportedly said he put his hand on a woman's bare back. And NPR's chief news editor David Sweeney has left the outlet after current and former journalists filed sexual harassment claims against him. So, Christine, what is your reaction to these latest cases, especially in the Lauer case?
You know, I have a different perspective. I've been a lawyer for 39 years as a woman, and I've seen a lot, and I've experienced a lot, as you can imagine, over these years. And, you know, sometimes my young daughters will say to me, why are you so, you know, why are you so vigilant about this? Why are you such a forceful feminist when it comes to women's rights? And just that I've seen so much. And so when this is coming out, I'm thanking God for Paul Ryan saying that this could be a watershed moment, because God knows I don't agree with him on almost anything, but I do agree with this. And, you know, it's very difficult for women to deal with this right now, because when men that you really admire, like I really like Garrison Keillor, I know a lot of us do, you know, and that comes out and you say to yourself, when men that you really love do horrible things or bad things. How do you handle that? You know, do we have a position of no tolerance, and must we? You know, I think it's important that we have to stand for something now, and we have to say, you know, it's not okay for a man to come up to his secretary and massage her neck while she's typing for him, and it's not okay for her to just have to sit there and take it. You know, there's so much that goes into this, and if we can shine a light on it now, I think it's really important. But what I'd really like to point out is there's two different things that we have to think about. You know, there's the public official, Senator Conyers and Senator Franken. And what does a woman do in a situation where she's, a federal employee or a staffer? And what does it happen in a private sector? In the public sector, you know, there is a real strong rule about reporting these events. And it's, I don't think many people really even know how hard it is. But, you know, you have to, if you can bear with me, it's really important that we understand what people have to go through. You have to, if you want to report somebody that does something to you as sexual harassment and you work for the federal government, you have to file a complaint with the Office of Compliance. And that complaint requires you to go into 30 days of counseling within 180 days of your request. And if you go through that counseling, you preserve your claim. And if you can't resolve it because the conduct was bad and they're not offering you anything, then they force you into mediation for 30 days with a government-paid lawyer, and you have to sign a non-disclosure agreement, right? And then if you can't resolve it there, then you have a right to file in federal court or to ask for an administrative hearing, all of this subject to confidentiality. So, you know, what's going on in the Congress is outrageous, and I really credit Representative Dana Locks and Representative Assemblyperson Voss, who are saying, let's look at the procedures in Wisconsin and make certain that we can do something more for making sure that reporting rules in our state don't follow those horrible federal guidelines.
Owen, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, Democratic Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, and Speaker Paul Ryan are calling on Democratic Congressman John Conyers of Michigan to resign amid sexual harassment allegations. But a lawyer for Conyers says the lawmaker has no plans to do so. Conyers, by the way, was hospitalized yesterday due to stress. And in addition, a fifth woman has come forward to accuse Democratic Senator Al Franken of Minnesota of groping her during a photo op in 2003. So where do you stand? Would Congress be better off without these two, or how do you approach this issue?
Well, I think in general, yes, Congress would be better off with those two. Clearly, they are pretty wretched individuals that I don't think we should accept as representatives of the people. That being said, I mean, I agree with a lot of what Christine said and what Congressman Ryan said, and that I pray that this is a watershed moment where much of this piggish behavior can be purged out of our working lives, if you will. And I think that what we're seeing, though, is a really interesting thing. And I admit I've worked in the private sector for a couple decades now, and the kind of grotesque upfront behavior that we're seeing Franken and Conyers and these folks accused of are almost unheard of in my experience. And I realize that's an anecdotal experience, but when you hear of anything even close to that, it's usually in the private sector, immediate firing, and it's done. And so the fact that we see in the higher echelons of our national media and our Hollywood culture with Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey and those folks, I mean, in the higher echelons of our media culture, in our Hollywood, and in our political culture, that behavior that reflects some sort of 1950s madman sort of mentality is ridiculous, that even still exists. And I hope that, and I wasn't aware of what Christine mentioned, that the rules are so stringent in the federal guidelines for people to report abuse like this. And I surely hope that we can make that a swifter, more just process as we do it. And I think as we go through each one of these allegations, we do have to look at each one on their merits. We can't fall victim of, there's a lot of accusations out there, fall victim of just assuming they're all right, although many of them appear very, very credible. So I think we have to make sure we have an open, process where people who make accusations can get a serious, fair hearing, and that there are serious consequences for that kind of behavior, because it should not be tolerated. And I think in much of this is an area where I think middle America, frankly, is decades ahead of the coasts and the elites out there.
Let's bring in Anne in Green Bay. Hi, Anne.
Hello. Well, I think this is all very disgusting, but it seems like with the Franken and Conyer issues, that's taken the spotlight off the pedophile Roy Moore. And I think he should be the first one to go. But my concern is who appoints the replacements for anyone who would have to resign.
Christine, go ahead.
Well, and, you know, the replacement, Moore is going to be replaced, or that seat will be of Jeff Sessions will be filled by the people of Alabama. And unfortunately, I guess we'll talk about this, he right now is about 6 points ahead of Doug Jones, which is unbelievable, but it is what it is. If Al Franken were to resign, Governor Dayton would appoint. And if Conyers were to resign, the governor of Michigan would appoint, who is a Republican. So, you know, it becomes tricky, obviously. You know, these are hard times, and the sacrifice that's going to be made to have these people be taken out, it's going to be difficult. So I think you've got a good point. What's going to happen if they go away? But, you know, this is a watershed moment. This conduct is not unheard of. I mean, women have been suffering this for a long time, and I think what we have to get away from is this kind of gotcha thing, like, oh, now it's Matt Lauer, it's Garrison Keillor, it's Charlie Rose, who's next? What's really important here is the women who have had the courage to come forward, and this is a change for women. Women have never been able to do that because they look at these women in Hollywood. Their careers were on the line. They thought, I'll never work again, and these were powerful women, and so think of the young aide, the young secretary, the young clerk, the young producer, who don't have any power. These are the women that have to be empowered. And if we can do anything right now, we can give them the opportunity to speak and say with loud voices. In the private sector, this is generally not tolerated. However, it does go on, obviously, as we've seen. But in the public sector, where we're paying for these people to serve as our representatives, it should not be tolerated on any level. They should serve as our role models. We got the worst guy in office, in my humble opinion, as our president, to be any kind of role model for anyone. We have to look at others and say they have to stand up and we have to stand for something.
The House on Wednesday approved a bipartisan measure requiring lawmakers and staff to take anti-harassment training each year. Hours before the voice vote, Speaker Paul Ryan said sexual harassment shouldn't exist anywhere, especially in Congress.
The fact that some people end up walking these halls are subjected to a threatening or hostile work environment when they came here to serve their country, to serve their ideals, that's wrong. That's a disgrace. We cannot and we will not tolerate that kind of behavior.
So, Owen, what else would you like to see Congress do in this situation?
Well, I think it's interesting. I was frankly rather shocked that they didn't already do that, because that is commonplace in much of the rest of business America to take sexual harassment training, particularly when you're in a position of management, which all legislators have a staff and people they manage and all of that. So I was shocked they didn't do it already, but it's certainly a valid step to make sure it's there. Then there are at least no excuses for them to say they didn't know or didn't know the standards, which, again, most of sexual harassment stuff is common sense for moral people. But the fact that it's not there was rather shocking. And I think something Christine said, a couple things you said, Christine, was really interesting. And a word you kept using was tolerate, and we can't tolerate this. And I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the things that's been really eye-opening for much of America, and certainly for myself, is when we hear about Harvey Weinstein and Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose and Kevin Spacey and all, you know, Charlie Rangel and all these things. Once the accusations are out there, we hear over and over again, oh, that was common knowledge in Washington. That was common knowledge in 30 Rock. That was, yeah, people just knew that. People knew not to be in a room around them. People knew not to the maids knew not to bend over near Matt Lauer. I mean, you know, these sorts of things come out where for decades this was common knowledge in some of those circles, which tells us that it was tolerated, that there were people in power and people in a position to do something about it who refused to do it because people like Matt Lauer were a cash cow for them. They made a lot of money for them. So I think we need to go beyond these people who are being accused, like Matt Lauer and such, and go to their bosses, go to the executives who run NBC. There's no rational way they had not heard some of these accusations or did not know it. It was clearly water cooler talk. It was clearly known. There are women who said they made accusations years ago and were ignored. They knew, and they didn't do anything about it. That's where the problem lies, and that's where we need to address it.
Let's go to Kathy in West Bend. Hi, Kathy.
Let me just say, I am not a fan of Floyd Moore. That info prior to any sexual issues coming up. But I think it is up to the constituents of each government elected official to decide who best represents them, whether it is Roy Moore, whether it is Al Franken. I don't care what political side they're on. The constituents should decide. And as the private sector, that's, you know, I hope that the bosses fire people who do things like this.
Kathy, thank you so much for calling in. Christine, in Alabama, three new polls show that good news for Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore, less than 2 weeks from Election Day. One poll has him leading Democrat Doug Jones 48-43%, another poll 47-42%. Emerson College poll shows him ahead 53-47%. Jones was up by as much as 8 points in one poll just a couple weeks ago. Moore is facing sexual misconduct allegations against several women from decades ago. Does it bother you in any way that Moore is out in front, given all we're hearing about?
Oh, yeah, it really does. You know, the women now that have come forward in a very brave way are being attacked. Their veracity is being attacked. The woman who was the restaurant, worked in the restaurant and had her yearbook, they're saying that she forged his signature. And they're attacking the women in a way that is really hateful. And I think that that is part of our problem here. And so what really hangs in the balance is the United States Senate here. This is a very important seat. And so the Republicans in Alabama have decided, no matter what he did, even if he was removed from the Supreme Court of Alabama twice, that's how bad this guy is, and now runs for Senate, and all these women come forward because when they were 14 or 16 years old, this creepy guy was going after them.
But as caller Kathy said, it is up to the state of Alabama to make this decision.
I know, but, you know, I think when I was doing some research on this, and people were going out and questioning people in Alabama about what they knew about Roy Moore, and many people aren't paying attention, and they don't even know who he really is. So it's unfortunate that the electorate isn't more informed, and if they vote for him, it's going to be a travesty for our country. I don't believe the Senate will eject him. I think that will be very difficult. But, you know, I just wanted to say with regard to this issue of harassment, there is the training issue that they're talking about, the bill in the House, just isn't enough. It's not just about training, as Owen said. You know, training is something you would assume. But there has to be more than that. There has to be training, but then they also have to have a simple and clear way to report claims, not like this horrible method that they've got in the federal government. And then there has to be transparency so we taxpayers know that we're paying for confidential settlements for these abusers. So going back, though, so I think Representative Wack's bill is an excellent one. But going back to Roy Moore, and this is all related, you know, people have to take responsibility for their vote. And I agree with Kathy, who said, you know, the people have the right to vote. They do, but you have to take responsibility, and you have to have knowledge, and you have to do research. And voting is something that is so critical. And, you know, if we think of the election box and the voting box as being one of the most important times you can spend as a citizen, the people have to spend the time and make certain they know what they're doing.
And Owen, I'll let you have the last word. We heard from Bill Stewart this week, Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama, saying that Alabama, you know, has about 15% turnout at the polls. So not high turnout expected. And what do you make here as we conclude this discussion on sexual harassment claims?
Well, I think with Roy Moore, I think what you see is, and I'm not going to defend Moore's actions, and they are 40-year-old accusations, but they have a lot of merit. They seem credible, and he seems like a creep or worse at this point. At the same time, I think you see the voters of Alabama saying that, you know, Democrats are really selective about holding people accountable for their moral outrage. And the same Democrats who supported Franken and who are defending Franken and Rangel and who elected Bill Clinton when he was an accused rapist and known philanderer, and Ted Kennedy, who, I mean, you go back in time, and Democrats were always very comfortable voting for morally decrepit people because they voted the right way. And I think what you see is a lot of Alabamans saying that, you know, I don't like Moore, but it, you know, we still need somebody who's going to vote the right way in the Senate. And the other guy, you know, he supports abortion up to 9 months. He supports, you know, massive tax increases. And this is a 6-year vote. This is a vote where that guy is going to sit in that Senate for 6 years and cast votes on behalf of Alabamans. And I think they, as the caller said, they have a decision to make whether they're going to swallow their moral outrage and put somebody in there who will vote it more in line with their beliefs, or whether they're going to go the other way.
We are in the mix of Week in Review, moving through week's developments with Owen Robinson, a columnist with the West Bend Daily News and a blogger at bootsandsabers.com. Christine Bremer-Moogley is an attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau. She was a member of the Electoral College in 2008 and 2012. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What caught your attention in the week's news? What do you make of North Korea's new missile launch and the reaction from President Trump? 800-642-1234. We'll return in just a moment. President Trump is threatening major sanctions against North Korea after the country tested another missile this week. This one is said to be significantly more powerful than the previous long-range weapon. North Korea also said it puts the entire U.S. mainland within range. We'll discuss this on this edition of Week in Review with Christine Bremer-Moogley, who is an attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau. And we have Owen Robinson with us, a columnist with the West Bend Daily News and a blogger at bootsandsabers.com. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. What caught your attention this week? What development have you been thinking about? Join in, 800-642-1234. President Trump is threatening major sanctions against North Korea after the country tested another missile this week. This one is said to be significantly more powerful. As I said before, North Korea said it puts the entire U.S. mainland within range. And President Trump later tweeted that the situation, quote, will be handled. Christine, how confident are you that it will indeed be handled?
I don't know. How do you feel about that? When Trump says it will be handled, and some of his other comments about bringing down force as this nation, as this world has never seen, on Korea, you can imagine how people feel about that. You know, we feel in Wisconsin, well, we're not on the coast, so we'll be all right. Now we hear, well, now they've got a missile that could put a nuclear weapon in any city in the United States. Chicago, you know, Milwaukee. So, you know, all of us should be very concerned about this escalation. When you know that we're dealing with Kim Jong-un, who is a man that is as unstable as our president, and then you've got the president calling him a sick puppy and little rocket man, and then in response we have this missile coming that can reach the United States with a nuclear warhead. I think that we should all be extremely concerned, and I think that instead of stopping all communication, as North Korea has now with the United States, we should be negotiating even more forcefully. You know, there was some hope that maybe once they showed their real might, they could put a nuclear bomb in the United States, that maybe they would that would cause more talks to take place. But now we find out that the president is about to fire the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, and put in place Mike Pompeo, who is even a more determined hawk on North Korea than the president, it seems.
Well, let's get Owen here.
I think it gets very difficult.
To jump in here on where do you see things headed here with North Korea?
Well, I think what we see, and I agree with Christine's take, that Kim Jong-un is relatively insane, remembering he's the third generation who's been running this backwater of North Korea, who's been isolated from the world as a hermit empire. So I think when you're talking about rational diplomacy, it's not really possible with someone like that. But what you're seeing is a pattern of behavior that we've seen from the North Korean regimes under Kim Jong-un and his father, and his father's father, but where they take this cycle of escalation, where they rattle their saber, they escalate, they do tests, they threaten. Before they had nuclear weapons, they threatened to the DMZ. They would do all this escalating behavior, and then we'd see the international community in the United States, we'd impose some sanctions, we'd be all in outrage, and then we'd have negotiations and we would give them something. So back in the day, Clinton gave them nuclear reactors. We gave them, we lifted sanctions. We gave them economic things. But what we see is Kim Jong-un has been trained in that sort of behavior where he's trying to do the exact same thing. So he's escalating right now in the hope that at some point the U.S. will back down, have those negotiations that Christine wants, and give them something. And I think what we're seeing is that this president isn't of that mindset, and he's not likely to do so. So where this ends, I don't know, but I think it is a grave concern, and I think certainly puts some of the smaller issues that we debate in perspective when you're facing a looming nuclear attack from a rogue nation.
Well, we are running short on time. So from North Korea to state news, turning to state news, Superintendent Tony Evers has asked the Wisconsin Supreme Court to disqualify Attorney General Brad Schimmel from representing him in a lawsuit related to the powers of his office. Governor Walker named Schimmel to be his lawyer, but since Schimmel sides with the position taken by a conservative law firm in the suit, Evers, who is also running for governor as Democrat, by the way, wants his own attorney instead. Christine, you're the lawyer. What do you make of this situation?
And a former attorney general in Illinois, assistant attorney general, of course. I think that the Supreme Court will side with Evers on this issue, but you cannot have an attorney representing you ethically who has taken a public position and is bound to take a public position against you. I mean, you have the right to an advocate who will push forward your positions. And so with Schimmel saying clearly that he agrees with the governor, I mean, and then his deputy is now the person that they're assigning to represent Evers, it's just not going to stand. I think that he must have his own attorney, let the cards fall where they may before the court, and so this issue can come forward. And, you know, last year the Supreme Court ruled that Evers, the superintendent of public instruction, did not have to abide by a very similar law that the governor is now pushing forward, requiring the DPI to have all of its rules that it promulgates to be approved by Walker before they go into effect. That's what this is about. It's more Walker taking power over rulemaking authority, so all the power in our state is centralized in his governor's office. That's what this is really about. And so all what we're talking about now is the first round. At least give Evers a lawyer who's going to fight for him so that he can put forward his arguments and let the Supreme Court decide.
I think you nailed a little bit earlier what this was about, and it's the fact that Evers is running for governor against Walker. And if you go out and look at his Twitter feed and his other media, he's out there touting this and you know, showing how tough he is, standing up to the administration, yada, yada, yada. But the truth is, it's the American it's the attorney general's job to defend the state government against lawsuits, and Evers' department is part of the state government. This is the AG's job. This is what they do. And Wisconsin was intentionally set up where the attorney general is a statewide elected office, elected separately from both the DPI and the governor. So, and we had, remember, we had for 10 years Democrat Jim Doyle was the attorney general under Tommy Thompson. And you didn't have Tommy running out hiring private lawyers or using different lawyers every time he was sued over something because he didn't want the attorney general to defend him. Absolutely not. Jim Doyle appointed lawyers who, by their ethics, are there to represent the state and to be a passionate advocate on behalf of their client, which is the state. So here I think we have what you have is a you have Evers, who is running for governor, who's looking for issues to differentiate himself from a very populated field right now of Democratic candidates. He's trying to get media attention, and this is just one way he's trying to do it.
The governor is also asking the legislature to sign off on about $7 million to pay for a national ad campaign to bring more workers into the state. He said a state chamber of commerce meeting that the ads will focus on bringing military veterans and their families to Wisconsin and young professionals in Chicago, Detroit, the Twin Cities, and elsewhere in the Midwest. Christine, will that be accomplished through this ad campaign?
Well, you know, I was reading Crane's Chicago Business talking about this ad campaign and Walker's attempt to bring people from Chicago and Illinois to our state. And, you know, from my perspective, I think that he has to do this because he knows that the people of Wisconsin will not fill these positions. And I think what's sad about this, being from northern Wisconsin, of course, and also being someone who cares deeply about our budget, that it's outrageous that this whole deal was put forward and the people of Wisconsin saying it was going to build jobs when, in fact, he's trying to recruit people from other states to come in and fill these jobs. So I think he should instead spend the $7 million plus the additional million he's already put forward to help us with our students that are here in the state, give them some reason to stay here, help support the University of Wisconsin. Let's try to keep our Wisconsin kids here and give them the help they need rather than spending $7 million to recruit people from Chicago to come and fill our jobs.
Owen, what do you make of this?
Yeah, this is where Walker is really a victim of his own success. And this is what we call the good problems, in that we have a robust economy. We have extremely low unemployment in Wisconsin. And we have big businesses coming here to build and create jobs and all of that. It's not that Wisconsinites won't fill those jobs. There's not enough of them to do it, which is a fantastic problem to have. So we see what we see in other states. We saw when Texas is booming and California is booming, when North Dakota had their oil boom, we see them going out and trying to find workers from other states who will come in and work here and become Wisconsinites. It's not like these are people who are going to come in work here and then leave. These are family supporting long-term jobs, average wage at Foxconn over 50 grand. These are good jobs that people will come here to fill, become Wisconsinites, and help continue to grow our state and grow not only our population, but our tax base and everything with it.
And we will leave it there. Thank you both so much for joining us on this Week in Review. Christine Bremer-Moogley is an attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wisconsin. She was a member of the Electoral College in 2008 and 2012. And Owen Robinson was with us. He is a columnist with the West Bend Daily News and a blogger at bootsandsabers.com. This hour of the morning show was produced by Bill Martins. We had technical direction from executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.